RehabCast, the official podcast of ACRM and the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, is sponsored in part by Shepherd Center.
My name is Zach Bradley. I'm a current employee and former patient of Shepherd Center, which specializes in medical treatment, research, and rehabilitation for people with spinal cord injury, brain injury, stroke, multiple sclerosis, spine and chronic pain, and other neuromuscular conditions. Our specialized clinicians serve as complex care partners. They collaborate with medical professionals who refer their patients to Shepherd Center to help them achieve optimal outcomes, returning them to their homes, communities, schools, and workplaces.
Learn more at shepherd.org.
Welcome to the 43rd episode of RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta. In this episode, we've got two swell interviews. First, we're talking with physiotherapy PhD candidate Sarah Suikkanen about her work in Finland with a year-long physiotherapy program targeted at seniors. Then we're going to check in with Dr. Brad DiCiano, the medical director of the UPMC Center for Assistive Technology. He'll give us a nuanced view of the role of the ATP in the assistive tech equation. Joining us now in the RehabCast, we have Sarah Suikkanen. She is a physiotherapy PhD student. She is a clinical physiotherapist and has her master's degree. She is doing her work in the Faculty of Sport and Health Sciences at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. So joining us now from Finland, Sarah is here with us to discuss her work, which is on frailty in older adults and the potential of rehabilitation interventions in this population. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, this is original research you and your team have published in the journal, and it's entitled The Effect of a 12-Month Supervised Home-Based Physical Therapy Exercise on Functioning Among Persons with Signs of Frailty. It's a randomized controlled trial, which is a challenge in of itself in this rehab population. Over a year, that is really something else. That's unusual to see a year-long intervention like this. We do a lot of interviews for the podcast. Obviously, we publish a lot of different rehab interventions in the journal. I would say it's much more common to see shorter epochs, a month, 3 months, 6 months at the outset. You really bit off something here going for a year. Tell us about that and how hard was that to achieve?
Yeah, we decided to try this kind of longer, longer intervention, and we took 12 months and all of it was supervised. So every single visit to this participant home, this physiotherapist went there, and yeah, it was something new, I think.
Really good to see, and large populations too. I mean, 300 folks enrolled in the trial, roughly 150 on each side, whether kind of getting the in-home intervention or not. So doing that over a year, I mean, that's a lot of visits back and forth and so forth. I see the intervention is two physiotherapist visits hour long per week. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So two visits per week, and both of them were supervised. So
yeah, the mind kind of boggles at the coordination and numbers there and so forth. How was this study funded?
This was funded by Social Insurance Institution of Finland. Half of it came from there, and half was this South Karelia Social and Healthcare District.
Okay. And I see that the research was conducted in the area of Lappeenranta, Finland. Is that right?
Yeah, or this is South Karelia, is the area.
I see.
In southeast east.
It's very close to the Russian border, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's like from Lappeenranta, it's like 30, 40 kilometers. Yeah, so it's just next to the Russian border.
Is this a rural area in particular?
There is 9 municipalities in this area, and Lappeenranta is the biggest city. But I think in Lappeenranta is about 72,000 inhabitants.
Okay, that doesn't sound too rural to me. Okay, very good.
But the smaller communities are rural.
And this study is targeted at older adults, those over 65, though the folks that you actually got into the study really quite elderly. On average, I see 82.2 years plus or minus 6.3. Most of them women, like it seems like most of these studies, but a fair 75% women. So significantly elderly population. And looking at this issue of frailty, which is certainly something that's affecting all societies, some more than others, as we live into our older years, thanks to all the available medical interventions in the earlier decades of life, more and more of us are getting up there into 80s and 90s and even beyond. And as a result, there's more work to be done in rehabilitation to potentially keep people in their homes. And that's really what this study is centered on. These are folks who are not in institutions, not in different types of residential care facilities or nursing homes, but living in their homes, possibly with some variety of social services. Is that right?
Yeah, they all were living at their own homes. Someone got some home health care, home care, but most of them didn't have at the time of enrollment. So,
okay. So on average, folks are getting some level of help through state programs to remain in their homes. Is that right?
Yeah. So, and the goal was to, with this kind of intervention, that they could live at their home also longer with this kind of rehabilitation.
Key to enrolling people was this frail questionnaire, kind of looking at different functions that may be declining and meet this definition of frailty.
Yeah, first we screened this population with the frail questionnaire, mm-hmm. and it was easy to fill, asking about whether they were lost weight or feeling exhausted or having problems walking a few hundred meters and so on. And if they get one or more points from that scale, then we did another frailty diagnose with this Fried's frailty phenotype criteria.
Y'all did the mini mental status examination too. I was a little surprised at how low you're willing to go on that number with the enrollment, getting folks with scoring down to 17 on the MMSE. That's, some significant cognitive impairment in this age group, right?
Yeah, and we thought it's good to have also those who didn't have that good cognition and also mm-hmm. those who had 17. Of course, it may cause some problems when interviewing the participants, but I think the mean was 24, if I remember correctly, on the...
Well, if I may say so, I do think it's a good thing. I mean, it reflects reality, and we see many rehab studies that seem to be kind of cherry-picking and a particular population that's going to be able to kind of learn the best, the rehab intervention and so forth. But meanwhile, kind of not really perhaps underrepresenting and underserving those folks with some degree of impairment who really do need that coaching and oversight and supervision from a therapist and so forth. And that really kind of reflects the reality that we live with out there in population health.
Yeah, they are still living at their own homes. So mm-hmm. that was also one key thing.
Even if there might be questions about whether that's the most wise thing to do.
Yeah.
but that's the reality.
It's the other topic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so the intervention, as mentioned, to my mind is rather gargantuan. Sending folks out into the home an hour twice a week for an entire year. The mind boggles a bit at the achievability of that. Now, these folks are receiving a variety of social services, and I do see that one of the outcomes is, hey, this we're hoping to see here too, whether this can kind of certainly help functionally, medically, and so forth, but ultimately, cost-wise, lessen the need for services overall. And it looks like you achieved that, and we'll talk about that. But let's talk about the intervention itself. What were the physiotherapists doing with these elders that was unique, attempting to prevent falls and injuries in the home and reduce the severity of frailty?
So during this 1 hour, the basic structure was like first warm up, and then about 30 minutes, 40 minutes of different kind of resistance exercises for the mostly. For the lower limbs. And mm-hmm. we used the ankle weights, weight vests, dumbbells, kettlebells to get some resistance. And then some flexibility exercises, balance exercises with different kinds of static dual task exercises. And also we did a lot of functional exercises. So that kind of everyday life tasks you need to stay at home and live at your own home independently. For instance, walking stairs or doing laundry, that kind of things.
So a lot of practical stuff that you might expect. Not rocket science necessarily, but things that we know from many other studies are key to ultimately not losing your footing and falling, you know, the practice and working on that lower extremity strength and coordination and just kind of repetitive strength building and resistance exercise. So kind of the bread and butter of rehab in that regard, but really getting it done over this expanse of time, which is something.
And yeah, and also for the 1 year, the whole time it was the thing. So maybe not the exercises weren't that special or new or something like that. But
Right. Now, there's, in terms of your outcomes, there's the FEM, which I think many people listening to this podcast would be familiar with. Also, the Short Physical Performance Battery, the SPPB.
Yes.
This one interests me a lot because, in particular, you're talking about how it predicts nursing home admissions as well as all-cause mortality. Tell us about the SPPB. Perhaps we should all be using it more.
Yeah, so it's constant three different tests. It's walking for 4 meters or 2.4 to 4 meters if there's not enough space in the homes, and then balance test, and then rising up from chair test where you rise 5 times. And
you did get a clinically significant boost in that over the course of this intervention, 1.6 points, I see.
Yes.
Despite, now that is important in terms of what its predictors are, I do understand that there is still certainly decline in all the functional measures over the course of the year. Again, this is a quite elderly population, folks on average in their 80s, some presumably beyond as well. You know, it would be asking for a lot for improvement over that course of that year or even static. So some decline, the idea is, though, a slower decline, right?
Yeah. So the FEM deteriorated in both groups, but it was less in our physical exercise group.
Yeah.
Group over the 12 months.
And fewer falls. I mean, some falls, as would be expected, but less falls.
Yeah.
Yeah. The exercise program is referred to by the mnemonic OTAGO, O-T-A-G-O. What is that?
It's Australian origin rehabilitation program. I think it's designed for these persons to do it individually or without supervision at their homes. And we use those five key lower limbs exercises of that. So it's the knee extension and flexion, hip abduction, and also the raise to your toes and to your heels.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like the main exercises of that exercise program.
Now, on the expense front, so ultimately, I mean, this does appear to be helping. There's, you know, on these measures, but the intervention itself does have an expense. But I understand when you look at a kind of a 2 year period, the overall costs are lower despite the intervention. Is that right?
Yeah, when we looked at this 24-month. Costs and in frail population, those who were identified as frail at the baseline, the costs were similar to this usual care. So even though this expensive exercise was there, these costs were similar. So they used less other health and social care.
Now, this work was done prior to the pandemic, and certainly since the pandemic, there's been a lot more interest on, you know, virtual and telehealth style therapies and so forth. One does imagine that older adults, in particular, this population of folks in their 80s and so forth, are going to have significant challenges with that. I mean, you know, using the devices, logging on, seeing and hearing, you know, people are asking them to do and so forth. Certainly is the safety aspect as well, utilizing the equipment and everything. I can definitely see some translation challenges there. One could imagine an intervention perhaps where less time from the therapist was involved in terms of maybe they go and set people up or something like that and leave. But what are your thoughts about kind of doing things more remotely and so forth? And is that something that you guys have looked at?
We didn't look at, but I think it's something that should be researched more and how it's going to be. But I think in our research, those population, in our research, I think they really like that physiotherapist went to their homes, and it was a social event. And I think it's an aspect that you cannot forget when you do these kinds of things. Of course, with this pandemic, it's different, but let's hope that it's
not too much longer. My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. And
And the socialization aspect is huge. I mean, I think for older adults in particular, the one-on-one in person is very important. Ultimately, virtual can only do so much. Now, certainly on the level of better than nothing, but it does deserve its research for sure. And I do imagine there's some patient populations for whom it's going to be superior for others, and different clinical problems superior to others, and so forth and so on. So I know this work is kind of a part of your PhD work in particular. I mean, tell us area of work involves for you.
It's also, this article was about functioning, mm-hmm. and I'm also doing about the health-related quality of life and also these costs and usage of healthcare and social services. They're also included in my thesis and also the effects for the frailty itself.
Very good. All right. Well, this sounds like certainly this is important work, big work, expensive work. And I think it's important for people, when this type of work is done with this much effort, we need to learn from that and take what we can, because obviously it's going to be challenging for other folks to replicate as well. It's certainly building upon a body of evidence that, many rehab interventions in particular, over the long term, pay back in spades what is spent. The challenge, though, is convincing the folks who are shelling out in the first place that it's wise from a social care perspective and so forth. And that's why we continue to need this type of research. So I really appreciate your time with us here today, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Joining us now on the RehabCast, we have Dr. Brad DiCiano. Dr. DiCiano is a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and their Department of PM&R. He's also medical director of the UPMC Center for Assistive Technology. He is also medical director of the Human Engineering Research Laboratories there. Dr. DiCiano, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Well, you and your team are looking specifically into the assistive technology professional field and perhaps its importance and relevance, hopefully relevant, given what they do, to the provision of mobility adaptive equipment. You guys have published this original research from yourself and your colleagues there at the University of Pittsburgh. In the first place, thanks for publishing in the journal.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for highlighting our article.
Let's just kind of get started with kind of some basics here. So it's certainly important and relevant to justify the members of the rehabilitation team. And perhaps the ATP profession is a relatively new one. I'm not sure. Can you educate me on that kind of timeline, how long that's been around?
Yeah, so the ResNA published a wheelchair service provision guide, which really outlines best practice for what occurs during the provision process for a wheelchair or scooter. And part of that recommendation includes, assessment, training, outcome measurement. And part of that process also involves, hopefully, certification of professionals to be part of that process. And ResNA also established separate standards of practice for people who can be certified as an ATP. Mm-hmm. And so now that large data sets are available, which has only, come into play in more recent years in the field of assistive technology, we can now look at the impact of factors like having ATP certification on outcomes of people who use assistive technologies.
So the ATP certification comes out of ResNA per se?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are there other professions that they issue certifications on, or is that the key one or only one?
That's the key one related to assistive technology.
Okay. Is this research born out of ResNA, like a ResNA subcommittee or something like that, or is it more just coming from you and your university research center?
This research was funded by NIDLR through a DRRP grant that we have with NIDLR, but many of us are involved in ResNA, have been members, and helped develop the wheelchair service provision guide and other resources available through ResNA.
Okay. What's your understanding of the kind of general percentage of mobility equipment that goes through ATPs in the U.S. versus that doesn't involve them?
Well, part of that depends on Medicare guidelines. Okay. So there are requirements that some types of equipment, especially when it's customized to an individual and it's a complex rehab technology, some of that needs to be evaluated by an ATP. However, there's lots of other durable medical equipment and other rehab technology that doesn't have that requirement and oftentimes isn't involved in a process that involves an ATP.
And certainly it's a field that's only getting more complex as more technology comes along. Certainly that would be one justification for it. Everything be technically correct and up to date with what's on the market and match for that particular disability and so forth. And that certainly makes sense. Now, as far as the mechanics of this particular project, you guys were kind of using proprietary data from a large company, I gather, U.S. Rehab, and there are hundreds of dealers and 1,400 locations. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, this data is collected by a lot of different providers across the country. Our data set had over 4,700 cases, and I think about 300 providers specifically contributed to the data set we used for this project.
Okay. And key to it seems to be this FMA questionnaire. Tell us what that involves.
Yeah, FMA stands for Functional Mobility Assessment. It's a way that we measure satisfaction with functional mobility as a result of a person using assistive technology. So it's a multiple item scale that allows us to measure how happy people are in their mobility as it relates to their wheelchair, scooter, allowing them to do those activities. And it was also developed by members of the team who were authors on this paper.
You guys were seeking to kind of match up what boosted those scores the most, you know, certainly whether an ATP was involved or not, or the type of equipment and those types of things. I guess to cut to the chase here, not to keep it a secret, ATPs are indeed important, and they have some interesting effects on what folks end up with. You tell us, but for the most part, it does seem that folks who have an ATP involved, for one thing, they're certainly getting more custom wheelchairs that are perhaps more appropriate for them in particular, something that requires that kind of next level of service of matching up their body type and particular disability with the equipment available versus something standard off the shelf. I suppose that makes sense. Tell us about what, you know, I guess is that aspect of it not surprising? And I see that there are some other details beyond that in terms of kind of the higher grade, i.e. group 3 and 4 wheelchairs, and tell us about how those are different from some of the others.
Sure. So as you can imagine, there's lots of patient level factors that are related to the ultimate FMA score. So we define a lot of different patient characteristics and factors that play into making a difference in the ultimate FMA score. But the biggest predictor in our study in determining what the FMA score for a user was the device type. Which makes a lot of sense clinically, right? If the person has a high quality device, their FMA score is likely to be higher. If they have a lower quality device, it's going to be less likely to be a higher score. However, involvement of ATP was also a key factor in determining FMA score. So when an ATP was involved in the assessment, the FMA score was higher. And like you said, also ATP involvement in the assessment was associated with having more custom devices. So that would include custom ultralight manual wheelchairs and the higher end power wheelchairs. Group 3 power wheelchairs are those that we think of as complex rehab technology, or power wheelchairs that we prescribe to our typical rehab populations, like people with spinal cord injury, stroke, brain injury, for example. And group 4 power wheelchairs have even more features that allow them to perform functions like standing in the chair, and also have some features for outdoor use.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Medicare actually requires the ATP to be involved in some of these. Are private insurers doing that too, the commercial insurance plans?
Most private insurers do follow Medicare guidelines. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And did I read this right? It looks like ATPs, they aren't just kind of upselling everybody, you know, regardless, you know, the most advanced thing. I mean, actually, if an ATP is involved in the assessment of mobility aid, there's an increased proportion of folks who end up with no mobility aid, as in the ATP is saying nothing is necessary. Is that right?
The overall assessment is to just determine what type of mobility device a person might need. It could be anything, cane, walker, crutch, you know, wheelchair, scooter, all the way up to a power wheelchair. So what we were looking at was sort of cross-sectional data where somebody came in with a specific type of device and we were determining the outcome of them with the subsequent device that they received after the assessment. And so future work that we're going to carry out is to look at what determines functional mobility assessment data longitudinally. Mm-hmm. If we look at people over time as their needs change, their mobility changes, the types of devices change that they use over time, what factors play into that?
Okay. And then in terms of, you know, the ATP field and so forth, I suppose they ought to be pleased by this research project. Is there an association outside of RESNA for ATPs? Is RESNA it? Have you started to get some feedback yet from this?
The main organization that, like we said, oversees the certification process for ATPs is RESNA, but many people who have ATPs are involved in a lot of other, you know, professional organizations. Mm-hmm. So this was, you know, one of the first studies to look at ATP as part of the process of evaluation in terms of outcomes. So, you know, we're hoping that dissemination methods like this podcast, you know, can get the word out about the study.
Very good. Very good. So you mentioned some kind of the next level work there being planned. I know you and your group in particular, you have a strong interest in this technology generally, but you do a lot with spina bifida per se in the pediatric population. Would you mind telling us about some of your recent work in that area?
Sure. So this study was part of a larger grant that involves multiple aims. So in this larger NIDLR grant that we have currently, we're conducting a scoping review to look at current policies around complex rehab technology and novel service delivery models that exist. We're looking at ways to standardize the assessment process and incorporate outcome measures that can kind of be standardized across different sites so that, you know, better protocols can be developed and better documentation processes. And we're also looking at existing data sets that exist on CRT. So lots of different suppliers and organizations collect data in different ways. And we're hoping that by examining different data sets and comparing them, we can come up with more standardized approaches so that if people start collecting data in similar ways, we have better, larger data sets to leverage for future research. And then we have certainly lots of other research going on in different areas, like you said, work related to the spina bifida registry, also work related to wireless technologies and mobile health and a variety of other areas in assistive technology.
What are some of the biggest needs or problems in the assistive technology world right now? I mean, to my knowledge, I mean, the main buckets might be, you know, getting people the right equipment that they need and also perhaps cutting down or limiting adaptive equipment waste that is out there, things that are bought, purchased, prescribed that are unnecessary, not used, and so forth. Those are things that, to my knowledge, are problems out there. Do you agree, or are there other big problems you would add to that list?
Yeah, I agree. Matching people to the right technology is really important. And that's part of why RESNA created ATP certifications, was to make sure that the person's own needs are really considered and a careful assessment is done so that when we procure equipment for people, it's carefully matched so that it's not ultimately abandoned. But I think even when we do match equipment to people correctly, the procurement process takes a really long time. There's multiple steps. The funding process and documentation process is very complicated. And so it can take a really long time to get people the equipment they need. This is really important for people with conditions that are progressive, like ALS, for example, who need equipment quickly. So we're always looking at ways to improve that process by standardizing processes, improving healthcare policy so that we can ultimately get equipment into the hands of people faster so that we can, you know, improve their outcomes. And one of the ways that we can do that is with electronic medical record interoperability. So I see a lot of potential for technologies as they're developing to speed the process of documentation so that we move away from paper-based and fax-based systems and we can do things directly from our electronic medical records to get people the equipment they need.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. DiCiano from the University of Pittsburgh, thank you for your time today on the RehabCast and for elucidating for our audience some of the details and considerations surrounding this important study of the ATP world and what that adds to the prescription of mobility aids. And I thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
And that'll do it for this 43rd episode of the RehabCast. Please share the podcast with colleagues, and please be sure to check out our next month's edition, number 44.